I'm Hillary Hendershot, your host, and this is Profit Boss Radio, episode 126. Profit Boss Radio is your weekly wealth mastermind. Profit Boss is also a community and a movement for women who are ready to take control of their money, break the glass ceiling, and give ourselves permission to finally have enough. Want the secrets of wealth to be yours? This is the place. I'm Hillary Hendershot. I'm a certified financial planner running a leading advisory firm for women, and I'm sharing with you real stories from real life and real women who are making it happen. Forget Wall Street. Let's do this, ladies. Well, today is the day. If you've sent me in a question, I am probably going to answer it in today's episode of Ask Hillary. We've got lots of great financial questions. First, we're going to be talking about how to pay off massive amounts of credit card debt or whether to file for bankruptcy. Then we're going to talk a little bit about how to think about school debt, whether that be a bachelor's or a master's degree. We're going to talk about credit repair. We're going to talk about how to create consistent income as a business owner. If you have inconsistent business income, how do you create consistent personal income? And then we're going to talk about whether or not you should consider subsidized home buyer programs. And I will say I have a little bit of, you know, kind of congestion in my voice. I had a cold last week, and I don't really know what podcasters do when they don't have a perfect voice. I still have to record the episode. And so, you know, it just is that way. This is life, people. Let's get right to your fantastic questions. First, from Monica. Hello, Hillary. I'm weighing the pros and cons of filing for bankruptcy versus undertaking a debt elimination program or other alternative to resolving significant debt. I have high earning potential and I'm generally feeling optimistic, yet my situation is that I'm going through a divorce and I've found myself with close to zero assets, no real property, no savings, and no plan. We amassed $160,000 in credit card debt and personal loan debts, plus $150,000 in graduate school student loan debt. I personally have about $50,000 of credit card debt with my name on it. In the case that he takes the majority of the debt, I'm still liable if he defaults. What's your financially savvy perspective? Okay, so Monica and I actually had some follow-on conversation because I needed to understand what was her income and expenses, and she referred to herself as having high earning potential. So I asked into that, and I also discovered that Monica has actually been to see bankruptcy attorneys. So, and I'll talk a little bit about the information that she gave me. She says she's been self-employed for 3.5 years, and in 2018, she paid herself about $52,000, but she thinks she can get a job for between $95,000 and $120,000, likely in her line of work, right? So she'll go from being a business owner to being a wage earner, and she says her monthly expenses are $6,500, okay? Okay, so Monica, first, congratulations on being optimistic. There really is nothing else to do but be optimistic. The opposite or other alternative is to be pessimistic, and that just doesn't serve anybody. So I love that. Let me say off the top here, I am definitely not qualified to advise someone whether they should file for bankruptcy or not. That is not what I do. I would think if it were my situation, you know, I would go see a bankruptcy attorney and I would make a list of the pros and the cons, and I would make a choice that I felt like I could live with for the rest of my life, right? So you definitely need a bankruptcy attorney to advise you about bankruptcy. But either way, because I don't think $150,000 in graduate school student loan debt is going to go away. So as far as I know, school loans aren't bankruptcyable, right? You're stuck with that. So either way, you've got a lot of debt to pay off. And I would be remiss if the first thing that I addressed wasn't mindset, right? Because sounds like you and your husband had a pretty freewheeling mindset. You were willing to live way beyond your means. Oh, also, Monica shared with me that her husband is, or soon to be ex-husband, is not working right now. I think she said he'd been terminated from, maybe laid off and terminated. So it's not like he has the income to pay off this debt. But point is that you all had a lifestyle that you couldn't afford, and you were okay with that. You were okay with borrowing money to pay for the things that you wanted without achieving the earning potential to pay it off, okay? So right now what you have is an amount of debt that you can't pay off given your current income. And so I just really stop, Monica, and if you're listening, you're in this situation as well, you first have to deal with the mindset, because if you don't become someone who isn't okay with living beyond your means, then even if you undertake the massive, massive action that it's going to take to pay off this amount of debt and get there, you'll just rack the debt right back up again. And I know, because I did that. So anyway, you definitely need a plan. You can't make a financial plan without knowing what your income is. So right now you're wanting to make a plan based on future earnings, but you don't have that job yet. So if I were doing this plan, it would be based on $52,000 of income, which is your 2018 income. And $52,000 of income doesn't even cover your $6,500 monthly expenses, let alone debt service. So I'm also still a little bit confused about the comment about your husband assuming the majority of the debt. Monica did tell me that she lives in California, and in California, the courts are likely to split the debt 50-50. And then it sounds like you might end up with an additional $50,000 of half the marital debt. So again, my understanding is that it doesn't matter if it was your name on the credit card, but because California is a community property state, debt gets split 50-50. So again, until we know the exact numbers, you really can't plan for any of this. So you need to get through your divorce and you need to go get that job. It's a lot of debt. You can't pay it with your currently income and monthly expenses. So something has to give. One good thing about this situation is that your plan of action is pretty much laid out for you. You need to go increase your income. So if you remember several episodes back, listen to the episode with Leslie. And, you know, she was in a very similar situation, multiple six figures of debt coming out of a marriage, and she took on that debt and she became a real estate agent. And it took her a few years to get her income up. But, you know, she did share that she's her goal is to make seven figures of income this year. Now, that's business revenue, but that's still a lot of personal income. And so if your earning capacity really maxes out at $125,000, well, we have kind of an untenable situation here. So if I were you, I would be looking for ways to make $400,000-$600,000 a year. And, you know, if you're listening and that sounds like pie in the sky to you, and, you know, you just want to say, you've got to be kidding me, did Hillary just say that? I get it, but it's a mindset. And to some people who are listening, they'll say, right, I can go make $400,000-$600,000 a year. It's going to take me a while to figure that out. But look at, somebody's making $500,000-$700,000 a year. Why can't it be you? Okay. Somebody figured it out. You can too. So Monica, and those of you listening who are in the same situation, to pay off massive amounts of debt, you need massive amounts of income. That's the straight math. Okay. It does sound like you're still mid-divorce now and that the debt hasn't been split up. I'm not sure who's paying the debt service, but since your soon-to-be ex doesn't have a job, there just isn't enough money to be paying on that amount of debt. So you've got to put the debt on ice until you have more income. Be in communication with the creditors. Let them know you cannot pay. Keep your word to them. If you tell them, I'm not going to pay for 6 months or 12 months, be in communication, right? Don't break your promises to the creditors. But whatever you say you're going to do, do that. So I'm sincerely hoping, again, that you've dealt with the mindsets that got you this far into debt. My concern is that you just have built a lifestyle where you're accustomed to living beyond your means and you're willing to continue borrowing and borrowing. So we're going to turn that faucet off, get through the divorce, maximize your income, and then you're in a position to deal with accuracy with that debt. So again, I can't advise you to file bankruptcy or not, but I definitely would do like a cost-benefit analysis. Let's figure out in which scenario am I going to have the better quality life. I hope that helps, Monica. Let's move on to question two. And Gina sent her question in via audio recording, so I'll play it for you.
Hi, Hillary. My name is Gina, and I'm from Dallas, Texas. I recently went back to college, and I have a bachelor's, and then now I'm working on getting a second bachelor's and a master's. So my big question is that I've already accrued debt from my first degree, a significant amount, And I was wondering if, or what resources I have available, or like what's the best way to go back, and not necessarily accrue so much more debt. I don't go to a university that's very expensive, but I still will accrue debt. So I was wondering if you have any ideas or any suggestions as to what I should do about this, or if I should take a break until I pay off more debt. My income doesn't allow me to, it doesn't allow me to pay for school as I go. So thank you so much, Hillary.
Hey, Gina, thanks for your question. I don't know a ton about your exact situation. I kind of, to answer this question, really fully flesh it out, I would need more information about what exactly you're doing in school, getting a second bachelor's degree and a master's degree. So I'm going to explore this topic carefully because I don't know you, and I certainly don't want to minimize what you do. I mean, maybe you got your first degree in literature and now you're getting formal education in nursing, which is a highly compensated occupation. Most of the people I see who are saddled with tuition debt did that because, frankly, they got comfortable being in school. I mean, I think many of the people I did my MBA with came to get the MBA because they wanted it to be a built-in raise. They're sort of hoping they could buy a raise, right? They hoped the employers would pay them more afterward. And my experience is that most of them were disappointed that that didn't happen. Maybe the working world is intimidating for you, or you'd rather be in school than face the fear of asking for a raise or gaining those hard to attain skills that let you work successfully with people and ask for raises and always be improving your own contribution to a work product or a team, right? Those are the sort of hard to teach skills that I think tend to differentiate the highly compensated from the average compensated. So again, I don't really have that information here, but I would say the best way to pay off school debt is to not have it. I mean, I don't know of programs that you would want to be a part of that are going to help you pay off school debt once you've already incurred it. The best thing to do is find a grant or a scholarship or a program that's super low cost and doesn't require you to borrow money. There are some programs for people like doctors and I think social workers who get out of school. And if you work in a community clinic for 2 or 4 or 5 years, then they forgive your school debts. And but, you know, you have to have a really low income while you do that. And that's the trade-off, is you promise not to have a high income and then they pay off your school loans for you. But it's like not clear that you couldn't have just paid off your own school loans and had a high income at the same time. So I do know a couple people who did those programs successfully. I think they have to be evaluated on a case-by-case scenario. I don't think they're a universally good thing. The only resource I know of that allows you to pay off debt is your own earning power. So really ask yourself, what are those degrees going to allow you to earn? With the exception of a master's degree in nursing, I don't know many master's degrees. Well, let's take the MBA as an exception, because you didn't say MBA and you would have said MBA if you meant MBA. But if it's just a master's degree in something, I'm not sure that that really significantly impacts your earnings capacity, more so than it takes 2 years to get a master's degree, right? Minimum 2 years of experience in the working world. So I think the really hard choice here, Gina, is if the schooling isn't going to have you earn a lot more money, then don't do it. Don't take on that debt. So much formal education at this point isn't justified by increased earnings capacity. So, and this is not a blanket statement. You guys know what I'm talking about. There are some degrees, and I've mentioned nursing several times just because it's something that I see so many people around me earning so much money doing, potentially even more net income than doctors who I get out of school with $500,000 in debt. So I'm just using nursing as a representative career, but there's also technical degrees and computers and finance, and these are career paths that tend to have high earning capacity. So you really need to think about whether the school is justifying its own cost with increased earnings capacity in the future. I know that's not the answer you expected, but I think that is the real harsh truth. Gina, I wish you the best of luck. Our next question is from Nikki.
Hi, Hillary. My name is Nikki, and I live in San Clemente, California. And my question for you is, on this last episode I listened to, I heard about a credit repair. Do you recommend this? And if so, do you have any companies you would recommend using? Thank you.
Hey, Nikki. Yes, I definitely recommend credit repair. What credit repair helps you do is make sure that there's nothing on your credit report that isn't accurate or doesn't accurately reflect your actual credit history. Okay, so it can be very helpful. I used credit repair after I had kind of dug myself out of my financial hole, and definitely they contributed to the fact that I was able to buy a big house in 2017. Did I buy it in 2017 or 2016? I think it was 2017. So I have a perfect credit score now. I think it's 780 or something, and that never would have been possible if it weren't for the credit repair service that I used. And because everything had gotten so complex, because I had made such a mess several years before. So once I was, you know, financially solvent, then I went for credit repair, because it was only really at that point that I was even qualified to, I was going to allow myself to borrow money, right? And that's all you need a credit score for, is to borrow money. So anywho, creditrepair.com was a sponsor of Profit Boss Radio, and I love recommending them. So definitely check them out at creditrepair.com. Good luck, Nikki. Our next question was written in from Anthea. Anthea, first of all, gorgeous name. She says, I'm self-employed as a sole proprietor, and I'm trying to figure out how to automate my finances / income. My income trickles in small amounts on an almost daily basis rather than as a regular paycheck. Also, do you still have a Facebook group? Anthea, no, unfortunately, I do not have a Facebook group. Facebook changed its willingness to let me archive what was happening in there. And for compliance purposes, I have to archive, meaning take pictures of and record, like, everything I do in writing. So everything I do on social media has to be recorded. As a side note, I pay an awful lot of money for that, but that's the cost of being a financial advisor. And so they weren't allowing me to archive things happening in the group. So I had to shut it down. That's it. It's unfortunate and I'm bummed, but that's the real truth. Now let's get to your financial question. So yeah, I have talked about this before. It's a great question. And many entrepreneurs, in fact, almost all entrepreneurs, have inconsistent business income, and you need to figure out a way to have consistent personal income. So you accomplish that by having separate bank accounts. So you have a business bank account where your inconsistent business income trickles in, and then you have a personal account where you create a twice monthly or every other Friday paycheck, essentially, for yourself. It's an auto draft, an auto transfer in the beginning. I personally am on payroll in my business, so I'm an employee of my corporation, but you don't do that in the beginning. In the beginning, you just transfer money from your business account to your personal account. And, you know, it can be hard in the first couple of months or maybe the first year of entrepreneurship. That's a time period when really anything I say, you can't really take any financial advice during that period, because you're doing whatever you can to have your business be successful. But once you get past that phase, you really should be paying yourself consistently. And that is accomplished in the beginning by auto transfers. And I do recommend, Anthea, if you haven't already listened to episode 84, which is about automating your financial success, that you check out that episode and the automation resources that I offered there. Thanks for the question. Our next question is from Tanya.
Hi, Hillary. My name is Tanya, and I live in Aspen, Colorado. And my question for you today has to do with buying a home. So, similar to Silicon Valley, Aspen is a very expensive place to purchase a home. And I understand that a down payment should be at least 20%. So in Aspen, that looks like $80,000 to $120,000 on the low end of things. So my question for you is, are there any ways to alleviate some of that down payment? I have read into piggyback loans and PMI. I know that there are first-time homebuyers loans, which I would fall into. But it seems like there's some conflicting ideas on whether those are good or bad things. My perspective is that I rent right now, and I know I want to live here. So it feels like it would be better to get started sooner than later. But I don't want to end up paying more by doing it too soon or doing it wrong. So thank you so much for your show, for all that you do. You are an inspiration, and I appreciate it. Thanks.
Tanya, great question. And I completely get it, all of that. Wanting to know that you don't do it wrong from a timing perspective, that understanding that it's a huge commitment and not wanting to get taken advantage of or do the wrong thing. So I get it. And luckily, the answer in this case is hands down, yes. If you qualify for a subsidized first-time homebuyer loan, and it's the right thing for you, it's a great thing for you. So first of all, you happen to pick a topic that I'm super familiar with, because when I was a loan officer for a period of time, I actually specialized in these loans. Now, I did it in the state of California, but the characteristics of these first-time homebuyer subsidized loans are pretty similar across the country. They can be very good. There are programs to help people with low income be able to afford home ownership. So first, let's talk about the types of subsidized loans that are out there. First, you have below market rate first mortgages, and you have ability to qualify for a mortgage with a low credit score. Then there are down payment assistance loans. So Hillary, I have my first mortgage. That's 80% of the purchase price, but I don't have enough money for the 20% down payment. Well, there are down payment assistance loans, and some programs actually offer free money. So in California for a while, there was a loan that it was a down payment loan, and then it actually got forgiven over time. So people didn't ever have to pay it back. So those are the types of loans that are out there. To qualify, you usually have to have a very low income for the surrounding area. Each loan program publishes its income maximums. So in this case, there's an income cap. If you make over that cap, you don't qualify as a low income person. But the credit score requirements are typically not that onerous. For example, you know, as I said, there are programs in the state of California that only require your FICO score to be above 620. Most people with a 620 FICO definitely cannot buy a house with a traditional mortgage. Now, the downsides to these loans can be the following. First of all, you do have to live in the house as your primary residence. You're not ever supposed to move out and rent it out. And the programs, the folks who run these programs do inspect that you're living there. They send you mail and expect you to respond. And some of them even do site visits. So you don't want to, you know, so it can happen that you get into a subsidized loan program, and then over time, you know, your income goes up, and maybe you've made so much money now that you can afford a down payment on a bigger, better house, and you don't want to sell this house, and so you want to move out of it and rent it out. But that's a no-no. Another downside can be that they restrict the amount of profit you can earn from owning that real estate. And when you sell the house, they either force you to sell it to another below market buyer at a dictated price, or they'll actually take your money. They'll take some of most of your market-based profits. So these loans are not typically an opportunity to profit from home ownership. They are an opportunity to get into home ownership when you wouldn't otherwise have been able to. So all that aside, Tanya, if you love Aspen and you know you're going to live there, then yeah, heck yeah, it would be appropriate for you to own your home. And, you know, assuming you have consistent income and, you know, I mean, I don't know, let's just take a stab in the dark. Let's say you meet a guy and, you know, Tanya, assuming you date guys, I mean, I don't want to assume, right? But you meet a guy who has four kids and now you're a family of six. Well, now that home that you just worked really hard to get into doesn't work. You know, so like things like this can happen, like life can change. But assuming that your living situation and family situation is consistent for a while and you feel like that's not going to change dramatically, then yeah, definitely you should do what you can to get into homeownership. Definitely try to avoid PMI. PMI is called private mortgage insurance, and that they give you PMI when you borrow more than 80% of the purchase price of your home, typically. There are subsidized loan programs that do not have PMI. It is an extra cost. It can be $400 or $500 a month. It's a real waste of money, but you're essentially paying the insurance policy for the mortgage company. In the event that you default on the loan, the mortgage company gets their money back and you're paying the premium on that insurance policy. So obviously that's not financially savvy, right? So avoid PMI if you at all can. Programs are administered by your state, potentially your county and your local municipality, so your city. So I don't know what county Aspen is in, okay? But if you look on the county website, there should be something there. Google below market rate home ownership in your county or city, and that should tell you what programs are there for you and what their features are. And I did Google programs in Aspen, Colorado, and there are some. So Tanya, you've probably already researched that, but you need to apply and get on a waiting list, and but you need to figure out how that program works. So, you know, for those of you who are considering wanting to own a home, you have my blessing on these programs. They're typically they can be very, very helpful. And I know some people here in my county, in my area, who have purchased homes through these programs and, you know, can be a real blessing. So good luck with that.
Hi, Hillary. My name is Ann Barton Veenkant. I am from St. Louis, Missouri. I'm 33 years old. And I'm really grateful for all of the podcasts that you put out there, so thank you so much for doing that. I know that with Ignite, you work with clients who have at least $50,000 in savings. I am not anywhere close to that. I probably am not including retirement savings. I have like $3,000 in savings. So my question is, how do I get started? What's the best way for me to get to the point that I have $50,000 and can become an Ignite client in the future?
Hi, Ann. I completely get it. And you've probably heard since you asked this question that I actually am kind of forced to close Ignite down to outside prospective clients as of December 15th of 2018 because of my daughter's health condition. But the question still stands, right? How do I get from 3,000 to 50,000? First of all, Ignite was 25,000, okay, not 50, but nevertheless, you know, the real answer is keep saving, set your lifestyle at a level where you're happy. You know, you spend X amount of dollars on entertainment and living and transportation and vacations and gifts, and keep it at that level. So if you're spending $5,000 a month, keep spending $5,000 a month. Even though you're going to get raises in the future, your earnings are going to go up. The idea is to not have lifestyle creep where your expenses keep going up with your earnings, but to save those raises. I promise you, Anne, the numbers add up quicker than you think. And when you start with just $3,000, it can feel a world away. But I promise you, what you're doing right now is you're earning and learning the skills of wealth accumulation. And at the same time, you're learning the skills of wealth preservation. So not dipping into savings and not having a lifestyle that requires you to dip into savings like I used to do. I am sure you're all tired of hearing this on the podcast, but I can't offer you investment advice. But if you do get that money invested in an appropriate portfolio for you, it will grow and compound over time. You have to suffer through market downs in order to enjoy and profit from the ups. And, you know, you'll be at $50,000 and even far more than that, just sooner than you think. You have the right mindset, Anne. Just keep going. This next listener voicemail is not a question. This was a compliment that came in from a woman named Nicole. She said her last name in the original voicemail, so I just edited her name out. So I just thought that Nicole's feedback so perfectly captured how I designed this podcast, how I execute on it every single week. Because look, there's nothing wrong with a podcast where the podcaster just talks and it's not necessarily valuable information. But for me, that's not what I want to listen to. I don't want to listen to people shoot the breeze, right? I'm turning on a podcast because I'm interested in information. I want to know if I should keep listening. And if you're talking about your peanut butter jelly sandwich or some inside jokes, that's not what I want to hear. It's not interesting to me. So I don't do that stuff. And Nicole's feedback was so perfect. And again, so again, there's nothing wrong. If you listen to podcasts like that, more power to you. But this podcast has never been like that and will never be like that because that's my style. And I'm assuming that if you're subscribed to Profit Boss Radio, that you resonate with it at least a little bit. So here you go from Nicole.
Hey, I'm calling with an acknowledgement for you. I've been making my rounds around other podcasts. And now that I listen to yours, I've started listening to others, and like there's literally no other podcast that I can stand to listen to other than yours. Everyone else, like, they take like 15 minutes to just talk and talk and talk before they even start the podcast, and I'm being made slowly insane by these podcast people. So I just really want to acknowledge you for your podcast and how clear it is, how direct it is, how fast-paced it is, or how intentional and how it moves with velocity. I really feel like I never waste a minute on your podcast. So anyway, I just wanted to acknowledge your excellent podcast. Very much enjoy it. Always listen to it when I can, and particularly always listen to episode 77, that Cornerstone Bedrock podcast, which is just such a brilliant piece of work.
That about wraps up this episode of Ask Hillary. I hope it's been very helpful to you. Wanted to give a quick shout out to new clients, Shelly, David, Lydia, and Josie. Thanks so much for your business. We love being your financial advisor. And now for some quick housekeeping items. Hey, Profit Boss. 2018 is rapidly winding down. As you know, the holidays are coming and I'm preparing a special episode that celebrates you. But this special episode also requires you. So if you have accomplished some big financial goals this year, I want to hear from you. If you're thankful for something that's happened in your financial life or career, I want to hear from you. If you're making big plans for 2019, I'd love to hear from you. It's incredible and inspiring and encouraging to hear about how women like you are changing their narrative with money and doing things they never thought possible. The truth is, your financial success is possible, and so many of you are already making that a reality. So don't keep your wins to yourself. Share them with me so that I can share them with the community. Don't be embarrassed. Fly your flag, girl. No win is too small. No win is too big. It's time for you to contribute and to be a part of making a difference. We are a tribe of smart, capable, powerful women who talk about our financial wins, express thanks and gratitude for important changes in our financial journeys, and look forward to a new year of financial and professional progress. Email your audio clip to media@hillaryhendershot.com. That's media@hillaryhendershot. Hillary has one L, Hendershot has two T's, .com. Come on, do it now. And then stay tuned for a very special listener-inspired episode. Thanks, ladies. Hey, I need to pop in here with a little business update. I've thought long and hard about how to communicate this to you and how to manage this transition. But the reality is, after Harlan has been diagnosed with leukemia, I do need to make some lifestyle changes. I need to be able to be available to her for longer periods of time. I need to be able to totally focus on her to make sure that she's well and safe and well cared for. So based on those realities and the reality that the time I have during the day is finite, until now I've been running three core programs in my business. One is Ignite Investing for investors with between $25,000 and $499,000 to invest. I have a high net worth comprehensive financial planning offer for those with above $500,000 to invest. And I also run the 50K Wealth Multiplier Experience coaching program. We are going to be closing up opportunities to apply to Ignite Investing as of December 15th of this year. If you are a current Ignite client, nothing changes. We are absolutely not taking anything away from you. Don't worry, it's all good. However, as of December 15th or after December 15th, we'll only take referrals from existing Ignite clients. That's it. So no new clients into Ignite program after December 15th of this year. I want to thank you for your support as I move through this transition in my life and in my business.